asking you to compare, to somehow smooth out my self-doubts.
I think you need to hear it. It'll help you understand there are things, however harsh, you learn to deal with in a relationship. You learn to tolerate, even come to understand in someone you love. Laura Lee,
he broke off, shook his head.
I'm just going to say it. Get it done. In all the years we were together, no matter how many times we talked about it, she still, God, she still got Star Wars and Star Trek confused.
For a second, Adrian could only stare. She felt the laugh bubble up into her throat, swallowed it down again. My God, Raylan, that's... I don't know how you lived with that.
I loved her. She tried to make up for it in countless ways, but she actually called Spock Dr. Spock every single time. I think it got to be deliberate, just to torture me.
No! Holding up a hand, Adrian turned her head away. I don't know if I can hear anymore.
Once, I brought home a toy lightsaber for Brad, and she thought it was so cute I'd gotten him something from Star Trek. Or, say, a group of us were having a discussion on the history and capabilities of the Millennium Falcon, and she'd ask if that was Captain Kirk's spaceship. It was humiliating.
Don't say any more. You've said enough.
I could go on, but I won't. My point is, love outweighs flaws. I loved her. I love you. I figure that makes me a lucky guy.
This isn't a conversation I expected to have sitting on the porch tonight.
I'll have to drop over between guitar lessons and pizza more often.
He glanced at his watch, popped right up.
Shit, shit, shit. I'm going to be late getting home. See? I knew exactly how much time I had, worked it out, and I'm still going to be late getting Bradley from Monroe.
He leaned down, kissed her, and she snagged his hand. If I tell you I love you back, are you going to be even later? He paused, took her face in his hands.
I've got to go, but tell me anyway.
I love you back. Eyes open and on hers, he kissed her again.
I knew that, but it's really good hearing you say it.
There's another flaw, your smartass flaw.
Still gotta go. Jasper, we're going. Damn it, why didn't I order the pizza while we were sitting here? Now, Jasper!
What do you want? She called out as he jogged to the car. I'll call it in for you.
Large pepperoni and Italian sausage. No judgment cracks on the meat. We're men. In the car, Jasper.
He had to give the reluctant dog a boost in. He paused again.
I promised the kids I'd take them to the carnival at the fairgrounds day after tomorrow. Come with us.
I like carnivals.
We're going to eat funnel cake and peanut oil fries and sliders, so deal with it.
She sat back as he got in the car. She would, she thought, as she picked up her phone to call in his order, with the addition of a summer salad for two. She'd deal with it, because that's what you did when you loved. Chapter 27. After her conversation with her uncle, Rachel decided to take what she had to the DC police. Not enough for a warrant. Not quite enough even to pressure Nikki to come in for questioning, she knew, but she appealed to a detective she knew to go to the house. A police badge carried more weight than a PI license. The detective, one she'd worked with years before, took her file, agreed something smelled off. It wouldn't be top priority, and she had to accept that, but he and his partner would get to it. Especially since she pressed on the fact that she had another conversation scheduled with the FBI agent heading Adrian's case. Nothing like a little competition with the feds to get the ball rolling. So Nikki could expect, over the next day or two, visits from the local Leos and the FBI. Shake the tree, she thought, and something would fall out. After her meetings, she drove back, through horrendous traffic, to her office to write up her report.
She dashed through pounding rain to the building that held her offices, the offices of a small legal firm, which often kicked work her way, and a photography studio. She took the stairs to the second floor, walked through the frosted glass door into her reception area. Three chairs with padded leather seats and backs sat against both side walls. A narrow alcove provided a space for hanging coats. A snake plant, as tall as she was, speared out of a bright blue pot by the double window. Her receptionist kept it thriving. Her business subscribed to a handful of magazines, including Forbes and Vanity Fair. Rachel had personally selected the trio of pencil sketches by a local artist, framed on the café au lait-colored walls. A high-class reception area, her marketing genius husband told her, brought in high-class clients. In the years since she'd opened the doors to McNee Investigations, he'd proved mostly right. Traffic. Rachel rolled her eyes as she hung her umbrella in the alcove. Unspeakable. It's pouring out there. Moving south, they say, but slow. Rush hour's going to be horrible. Great. Something to look forward to. On the way to her office, she had short update conversations with her two colleagues, hit the tiny break area for coffee. After another longer conversation, with wedding plans sprinkled in, with her office manager, she sat down in her office, then sat back, sipped coffee, closed her eyes to let the tension of battling DC traffic in a summer deluge wash away. The rain also meant her husband's softball game would be canceled, so she, or he, would have to think about dinner. Order in, she decided. They'd both be fine with that, especially since they'd both deal with the traffic to get home. And if neither of them had to bring work home, they could open a nice bottle of wine, have a leisurely family meal neither had to cook. Maybe even work in some sex before they conked out. Which meant, if she wanted all that to happen, she'd better finish up work. She wrote the report, attached it in an email to Lena, as that's how her paying client preferred it. She sent her office manager her hours for billing, said paying client. Before she reached for the phone to contact Adrian for an update, as both of them preferred, the phone rang. McNee Investigations. Rachel McNee. Ms. McNee, it's Tracy Potter. What can I do for you? It may be what I can do for you. I've been doing a little research, and yes, you suggested I shouldn't do so, but it's what I do. In any case, in doing so, it jogged some memories. One being, I remembered overhearing a phone conversation John had with his wife. And yes, I was eavesdropping.
So would I, under the circumstances.
Or any, Rachel admitted. Nosy was in the DNA of an investigator. I recall him being very dismissive of her. Something about the kids, or one of them. How, no, he couldn't drop everything and come home. He had work to finish. How she should just handle it. Then I remember him snapping at her. If you can't deal with it, just take another pill. I'll be home when I'm home. Or something of the sort.
All right.
I admit I was amused. I stood in the bedroom doorway of the little apartment he kept for his trysts. Said something like, trouble at home or trouble in paradise. I remember his response as it was fully my intention at the time. Never get married, and if you do, don't have any goddamn kids.
Tracy let out a little laugh.
That's 19 for you. In any case, he went on a short rant, which surprised me because he never talked about his family. I never talked about them. But we'd both had a couple of drinks.
Do you remember what he said?
I remember the gist. He said his wife had wanted the brats in the first place and he should have made her get rid of them before they were born. And now, even though she had someone come in to clean, to cook, she couldn't handle them.
Tracy paused a moment.
I wasn't interested in his family issues, but I remember wondering how he could afford all that household help on his salary. I didn't know it was her money at the time, and it struck me. Mostly the conversation bored me, so I said something like, why don't you come to bed and handle me? And that was that.
Interesting.
I think so. It occurs to me Lena Rizzo might not have been the only bed partner he got pregnant, as he resisted suiting up.
She'd already thought of that possibility herself, and had pursued that area of inquiry before.
I assume this wouldn't apply to you. No. Then again, our affair was brief. I was on birth control, and I insisted he use a condom. He didn't want to, complained and resisted, but that was a deal-breaker for me. Maybe my impressions colored some, but it struck me he had nothing but contempt for his wife and considered his children a burden. And that leads me to a second, somewhat vague memory.
Go ahead.
I honestly didn't recognize any names on the list you showed me, but college was a long time ago. But this memory made me think of this girl in the Shakespeare Club. John ran that. I stayed in it because whatever else he was, John was an exceptional teacher, and his insights on Shakespeare were brilliant. I couldn't remember her name even when I thought of her. I do know she was new, a freshman, and I think I was a junior or senior at that point.
You think she and John had an affair?
John had a type, I think. He liked them young, bright, attractive, and with good bodies. She had all that. On the shy side, but she bloomed in that club. And since I'd once had a fling with him, I recognized the signs.
What about her stands out to you now?
She stopped coming abruptly, and, as I said, she bloomed there. I figured the affair had gone south, and she was heartbroken or embarrassed. I said something to a friend who happened to live in the same dorm. Catty, I admit. That's when I heard the story. The girl. And I refreshed with my old college friend, who remembered her first name. Jessica. Jessica came home to the dorm one night, beaten up. Now, this is third hand, as while in the same dorm, my friend wasn't even on the same floor, but she heard Jessica staggered into the dorm with bruises all over her face, and eyes swollen shut, and more, with her pants soaked with blood. A miscarriage. Rachel circled the name Jessica on the notes she took, underlined miscarriage.
Police report? Medical records?
The word was she claimed she'd been mugged, couldn't identify the attacker. Wouldn't, anyway. She refused to let her dorm mates call an ambulance or the police, which of course they should have done anyway. She dropped out, according to my friend.
I'd like your friend's name and contact information.
I asked, and she'd rather I didn't give that out, unless it becomes clearly relevant.
It's part of the whole, Ms. Potter.
I agree, but a source is a source. I'll press her on it, but for now I can't give you that information. And I can't tell you where this Jessica lived back then or even her last name. However, I want to say I'm sure, but in fact can only say I'm about 70% sure, that this was the same time John came into class with his right hand bandaged. He made a joke about English professors never attempting home repairs. We all laughed, and that was that.
This is very helpful.
Is there a Jessica on the list?
Two, in fact. A fairly common name. Do you remember what she looked like?
A brunette. And my image is of young, fresh, pretty, slim but curvy. But that's it. I wouldn't recognize her if I saw her. I'm sorry. We interacted in the club, but that was once a week for a few months.
Do you remember when this happened?
I'm nearly sure it was in my junior year, and after the winter break. I know it was cold, and I'd moved into a group house off campus. Wait, yes, now that I'm pinning it, I'm positive it was early January. The first, or possibly the second, club meeting after the winter break. I think the first.
Nodding to herself, Rachel wrote down the probable year, circled that.
Okay. I'd like to know if and when you locate her. I could have warned her, but I didn't. She may not have listened, but I could have told her what he was. I have to get into makeup. I have some promos to do before news at 5.
If you remember anything else, I'd like to hear it. Thanks for passing on this information.
Rachel sat back, considered. She'd managed to track down both Jessicas on the list. One, who predated Lena with her relationship with Bennett, lived in London. Born and raised in England, and Tracy would certainly have remembered an accent. Plus, an earlier liaison. But the second Jessica hit the right age. She'd vehemently denied having any sexual relationship with Bennett, which even in the brief phone conversation came off as an angry lie. Rachel pulled up her notes. Yes, Jessica Kingsley, nay Peters, married to Robert Kingsley, pastor of the Church of the Savior, for 24 years, mother of four, who lived in her hometown of Eldora, Iowa. First time away from home, Rachel mused, shy and excited. Falls for charming professor. Goes home for winter break and finds out she's pregnant. Tells Bennett, who reacts as he did with Lena Rizzo, but this one can't defend herself. Shamed and shocked, she manages to get back to her dorm as she miscarries. Makes up a story. Goes home. Probably blames herself. Hides the incident. Buries it. Does she tell her future husband before the wedding? Or tell him ever? Unlikely. She'd fear she wouldn't be forgiven. Instead, she made her life in her little town and kept it buried. I could have warned her, Tracy'd said. And though Rachel had, or had tried, she knew she had to try again. She got a bottle of water from her mini-fridge, walked around her office chugging it as she considered her approach. If she didn't try, and something happened to Jessica Kingsley, she'd have to live with it. She didn't want to live with it. She closed her office door, a signal not to disturb, then sat and pulled the phone number from her file. The woman answered, obviously distracted.
Hang on a minute, I'm getting a pie out of the oven.
Rachel heard rattling, humming, footsteps.
Sorry. Hello.
Miss Kingsley, this is Rachel McNee. We spoke a few weeks ago.
I told you this doesn't involve me and not to call me again.
Please don't hang up. You don't have to say anything. I'm just asking you to listen for a minute. Whatever happened or didn't happen at Georgetown, your name is on a list. What I didn't know when we spoke before but have confirmed now is five women on that same list are dead. Were murdered. I need you to be aware of that, aware there may be more I haven't yet found. The police and the FBI are investigating and you may be contacted. I couldn't, in good conscience, withhold this information from you, and I'm only advising you to take precautions.
Why should I believe you?
Why would I lie?
For all I know, you're some reporter trying to spread fake news like all the rest of them.
Rachel just closed her eyes.
You can Google my name, the name of my agency. I simply want you to be aware someone is killing women who went to Georgetown University whose names are on a list, as yours is.
Fine, you've told me. Now leave me alone.
Rachel only shook her head when the phone slammed in her ear. Apparently Jessica hadn't just buried the incident. She'd put it in a concrete bunker, filled it with denial, then sunk it in the ocean's depths.
Did my best, she mused.
She had an hour before she had to fight her way home because maybe the rain would move south, but it didn't seem to be in any hurry. She'd spend it working on finding one more name on the list. Just one more tonight. It took nearly 2 hours, which meant her fight home would be a brutal battle. But she found two. One alive, a professor herself at Boston College, who not only admitted to the affair, but took Rachel seriously. And one dead, a lawyer who'd been stabbed repeatedly in the parking lot of a supermarket a few miles from her home in Oregon. Since her purse, her watch, weren't found, and her car located more than a week later in Northern California, the motive was ascribed to carjacking and theft.
He took the car. So how did he get to the parking lot? He had to have followed her in another vehicle. Stolen too? I say absolutely. But let's find out.
She glanced at her watch. Cursed.
Later.
She gathered her things. Shut down her computer. And, she noted, once again left the office after everyone else. She really had to stop that. She grabbed her umbrella, locked up the office behind her, and called her husband to let him know she was on her way, and to order pizza, and open a bottle of wine. She ate with her family, drank wine, even managed to sneak in a quick, quiet romp with her husband. But she knew she wouldn't sleep.
She slid out of bed, shrugged into sweats, then went into her office. She could hear the TV blasting from the family room, so she shut the door. It might have been after 11 in D.C., but it was barely 8 in Oregon. She could get lucky and find somebody who'd care enough to check on stolen cars recovered from the parking lot where Alice McGuire, nay, Wendell, was killed 5 years before. About the time Rachel used her persuasive powers on a detective with Portland PD, Tracy Potter sat in her tiny dressing room cleaning off her TV makeup, which by the end of her 11 o'clock broadcast felt like it weighed 50 pounds. And when she slathered on moisturizer, she swore she heard her grateful skin make slurping sounds as it drank it in. With the rain pounding, she wanted to change out of her TV-friendly suit, switch her heels for the rain boots she kept on hand for nights just like this. She cursed herself for parking at the far end of the lot, which she did whenever she was shy of her 10,000 steps a day, which was, she admitted, most of the time. Her husband would be dead asleep when she got home, and who could blame him? But she thought she might unwind with a snifter of brandy before joining him. Her crew long gone, she called a goodnight to the stragglers who remained. She took the back door, let it slam securely behind her as she opened her umbrella. Even with the security lights, she could barely see 2 feet ahead as the rain whooshed down in sheets blown by the wind. She blessed the boots, told herself how smart she'd been to take the time to change into jeans as the rain splashed up on her legs. She had the key in her hand, hit the button on the fob to unlock the doors. The lights blinked. She didn't hear the usual thump of the locks, but the rain pounded. She half jogged the rest of the way, then, closing her umbrella, all but dived into the car. "Jesus Christ," she muttered, and reached to press the starter button. She didn't have time to scream. The hard yank on her hair pulled her head back. The knife sliced deep across her throat. She gurgled, eyes wheeling, arms flapping. "Like a fish on a line," JJ snorted with laughter. He shoved her toward the passenger seat. In his disposable painter's gear, including bonnet, gloves, booties, he jumped out of the back. He gave her, no longer gurgling, a harder shove as he took the driver's seat. "You made a real mess of things," he told her as he started the car. "But that's okay. We're not going far." He congratulated himself on knowing, just knowing, tonight was the night. The rain, the perfect sign, the perfect cover. He'd dump her car in the strip mall lot a few blocks away where he'd left his sister's. Bag up the protective gear and get rid of that somewhere along his drive to D.C. A handy rest stop would do. He glanced over at Tracy and thought, "One bitch down, 3 to go." Adrian often used either Maya or Tisha as guinea pigs. Today, she used Tisha to fine-tune a cardio dance segment for a project. "Come on, Tish, this one's supposed to be fun." Teething baby, broken sleep, nursing boobs. "Cardio like this gives you a nice energy boost. Triple step now. Right, left, right. Use your hips. That works the core. Where's your rhythm? You're a black girl."
"Don't you stereotype me."
But she laughed.
"And my rhythm is desperate for a nap."
"Chasse, back step, right, left, right. Now the turn. Remember those happy hips?"
"My ass."
"It's definitely good for that, too."
She whipped, cajoled, snarked Tisha through it.
"This is going to work."
"I never want to see the recording."
"For my review only. I think I need to funk it up more. It may be a little too easy."
"Again, my ass."
When Tisha dropped down in a chair in the studio, Adrian got her an energy drink.
"Perk it up. I need to work on the strength yoga."
"I am not doing that."
"I have to nail it down first anyway. I want the whole program solid before my mother gets here. I've got most of a week. A short one today, though. I'm going to the carnival with Raylan and his kids later."
Carnival. With kids. You're in deep, Adrian.
I am. He dropped over for about a half hour 2 days ago, and one thing led to another.
Tisha leaned forward. Tell all.
Not that another. Jeez, it's sex, sex, sex with you.
I wish. Monroe and I are down to 1.6 bangs a week.
0.6?
Cordis interrupted us. We average 1.6 right now. We've vowed to increase our average to a solid 2 and work up from there when Finn, thank you Jesus, starts kindergarten at the end of August. We can grab a nap time quickie once a week.
Well, that's a plan.
Spontaneous sex is overrated, I seem to recall. Anyway, what thing led to another thing?
He told me he loved me. It scared the crap out of me. I knew it was coming, I'm not stupid, but it still scared the crap out of me.
Aww. The awe had Adrian throwing up both hands.
And I'm babbling around making excuses or reasons or putting up roadblocks, and he's so patiently determined. Determinedly patient? Both. And also quietly, firmly sure of himself. And me. And us. He pointed out my flaws.
Well, that's romantic.
It actually was, because he sees them, knows them, and he's fine with them. He listed some of his own, and all I could think is, I'm fine with them. And I told him I loved him. Because I do.
The L word was exchanged. The biggest four-letter word there is. Yay! And about time.
About time? Tish, we've only been together for a few months. Barely.
Tisha just waved that aside.
You've known each other forever, and you've always had a thing for him.
No, I haven't.
Now she flipped a decisive index finger into a point.
Have too.
And don't make me sound like Finn. Way back, when you told me about Maya, you talked about her older brother. And there was this spark.
No.
Yes. That was more than 10 years ago. You had a lot to say about him.
I did?
His art, his green eyes.
Oh, God.
She sat down, laughed at herself.
You're right. I did. I think, now that I can think about it, I fell for him the day I saw the drawings on the walls of his room. And then the way he looked at me. Those eyes. When I said I really liked them. What was I? 7?
God! With equal surprise and amusement, she slapped her hand on either side of her face and shook her head.
Then he shut the door in my face, as any respectable boy of 10 would. I guess I never let it surface, especially after Loralee.
Because in the endless stream of the space-time continuum, this was the time and the place.
Sure, that explains it.
Yes, it actually does. You're good together, Adrian, so that's number one, because a lot of people who fall for each other aren't.
And I've got to go.
She pushed up. You know, Raylan's kids are going to tell Phineas about the carnival. I'm going to end up getting my ass dragged there.
Yes, let's meet there. It'll be fun. I'll text Maya, see if she and Joe and the kids want in.
Are you making a crowd to hide your love?
No. We all deserve some fun. And hey, it's a carnival.
Long before the summer sun set, music blasted, rides whirled and twirled, kids, and plenty of adults, squealed. The air filled with scents of fried sugar, grilled meat, bubbling grease, radiated heat and humidity. Midway Games drew hopefuls who'd shell out $20 for a chance to win a $2 toy. Bells clanged, wheels spun, air guns popped. The minute they parked in the field with dozens of cars, Bradley grabbed Raylan's hand.
Let's go, Dad. I'm starving. I want 2 hot dogs and fries and funnel cake and ice cream and...
If you eat half of that before you get on the rides, you'll puke.
Nuh-uh.
Yuh-huh.
Pick some rides first, then chow, then we'll do some games before any more rides.
I want the Matterhorn and the Tilt-A-Whirl and the Ferris wheel.
In her delight, Mariah executed a very nice cartwheel.
You up for this?
Raylan asked Adrian.
Absolutely.
At the admissions booth, he bought 4 full access passes, then scanned the wild maze of booths and rides.
Looks like Matterhorn's first up.
I can ride it this year.
Mariah reached up for Adrian's hand.
I wasn't tall enough last year, but I grew. We measured and everything. I only have to do baby rides if I want.
How about you ride with me, Mo?
I can ride with Adrian, Daddy. We're the girls.
We're good, Adrian assured him.
And they were, tucked together in the bobsled car, swinging out and in, faster and faster until the world was a blur. Beside her, Mariah let out screams, wild laughs, screams. When they slowed, she beamed up at Adrian.
This was the most fun in my whole life.
There's more where that came from.
The minute they hit the ground again, Mariah leaped up into Raylan's arms.
Can we do it again? Can we?
My fearless femme.
He rubbed his cheek to hers.
Sure. But why don't we hit something else first?
Text from Tisha. They're parking, and Maya and Joe pulled in right behind them.
Why don't you tell her we'll meet them at the Tilt-A-Whirl?
Can I get cotton candy when we eat?
As they walked, Raylan looked down at Mariah, then over at Adrian.
You might have to put on blinders.
Do the ring toss, Dad. Can I have a penknife when you win?
When you're 13, Raylan told Bradley.
That's forever away.
How come you claimed you were almost a teenager the other day?
Bradley executed the 180 flawlessly.
I almost am, so I should have a penknife.
Does not compute.
But Raylan paused by the ring toss game. Bought tickets. He spotted a fancy pink penknife. Flipped the ring. Ringed the bottle with it.
How did you do that? Adrian demanded.
It's just hand-eye coordination and some basic physics.
He handed her the prize.
You're old enough to have this. Be responsible.
He won a gaudy necklace for Mariah, a pen with multicolored ink for Bradley.
That shouldn't have been possible, Adrian commented as they continued to the next ride.
Yeah, that's what the guy running the game usually says.
When they met up with the rest, Phineas studied the whirling ride with sorrow.
I'm not tall enough. You will be next year,
Mariah told him.
I just got tall enough.
It's all right, my man. I'm tall enough, but I don't go on those puke machines.
Monroe already had the baby kicking his feet in his stroller.
You, me, and Thad are going to hit the other rides. Why don't you give me your short stuff there, Maya, and I'll take her with us.
3-1?
Patting Quinn's bottom in the front pack she wore, Maya shook her head.
I'll stick with you this round.
I'll rotate with you.
Joe leaned over to kiss Maya, then rubbed his hands together.
I love me some puke machines. Ready for your first whirl, Colin? You just hit tall enough.
He bit his lip.
I guess.
You don't have to. You can come with us,
Maya told him.
No, I can do it.
He did it, but unlike Mariah, came off with eyes wide and shocked. He managed 2 more rides with eyes like blue glass moons.
Let's give Mom a chance, okay with you? We'll help Monroe with the little guys.
Okay. We gotta be fair.
Wobbling a little, Colin took Joe's hand as they walked toward the kiddie rides.
I didn't puke.
Guts of steel.
After the first round, they ate what Adrian judged to be a ridiculous amount of meat, sugar, and fat, then walked off what they could on the midway as dusk settled in and the lights began to beam. Like magic, she thought. And like magic, Raylan popped balloons with darts to win Mariah a huge stuffed unicorn. At the shooting range, he consistently pinged wolves, roosters, bears, coyotes as they rotated, taking away a robot for Bradley.
No, seriously, Adrian demanded. How do you do that?
He just shrugged.
It's my superpower. Ball toss over there,
he pointed.
See anything you like?
Adrian laughed. Have some pity on the carnies, Midway man.
I like the octopus,
Phineas told him.
Octo means eight, and they have eight tentacles.
Let me see what I can do.
He bagged the octopus for Phineas, a stuffed snake for Colin.
I got this.
Joe pointed toward the high striker.
Swing a hammer plenty. I'm gonna ring that bell.
He handed Maya the light-up sword he'd won, rolled his shoulders. He swung the hammer up, slammed it down. When it stopped just short, he claimed practice round, passed off more tickets. The second swing, the bell rang, lights flashed. My strong man. Maya fluttered her lashes and took the stuffed, big-eyed cow.
Don't look at me.
Laughing, Monroe waved his hands in the air.
I already won these magic crystals by pure luck. I'm a music man, not Thor.
Before Raylan could step up, Adrian raised a hand. I'll try it. The operator smiled at her.
Good luck there, missy.
The hammer had more weight than she'd anticipated, but she planted her feet, hefted it, brought it down. The weight stopped a full 10 inches short of the bell.
That was a nice try, little lady.
The operator handed her a hairband with light-up, bouncy flowers. She put it on, rolled her shoulders back, rolled them forward. One more time. Raylan peeled off the tickets. She gripped the hammer, took her stance, tipped her head side to side. Breathed in, breathed out, breathed in and swung on the exhale. The weight flew up, banged the bell, set the lights flashing. Little ladies don't have these. She flexed her biceps. The carny laughed.
Guess they don't.
Chapter 28. About the time Adrian rang the bell, Rachel found two more dead women, making her total eight. More than 20%, she thought. No one could ignore that. No one. She wrote it up, sent copies to the DC investigator assigned, to the FBI agent. She left voicemails for both, pushing action on interviewing Nikki Bennett. And the hell with it, she thought. She was giving that another shot herself. She texted her husband. Sorry. Sorry. And one more sorry. I know I'm already really late, but I have one more thing to deal with. Maybe another hour to hour and a half. As she shut down the empty offices, he texted back.
Working too hard, Rach. All's good here. Maggie's hanging out at Kiki's tonight. Sam trounced me twice in Fortnite, so I'm taking my solace in a book. If you've got time, pick up some Buttercrunch ice cream. I may need more solace.
It made her smile as she locked the door behind her. I'll make time and solace with you. Love. When her cell phone rang, she noted caller blocked on the display. In her line of work, she just couldn't ignore. Rachel McNee.
Ms. McNee? This is Detective Robert Morstead with the Richmond PD, Major Crimes Unit.
Richmond, she repeated as her blood chilled.
Your name and number were found in the address book of Tracy Potter.
Rachel leaned back against the locked door. If I could have your badge number so I can check your bona fides. As he gave her the information, including the name of his lieutenant, she unlocked the door again and put on the lights. Just hang on a minute, please. Back at her desk, she used the landline to verify, then sat back a minute, closed her eyes.
Detective Morstead, I contacted Tracy Potter and have spoken to her twice in connection with an investigation I'm conducting. What happened to her? Detective, I was on the job in D.C. for a decade. You can check on that. I'm currently working with Detectives Bauer and Wachowski, MPD, and Special Agent Marlena Krebs of the FBI.
She got up for a fresh bottle of water as she spoke.
Your major crimes, so I have to assume Tracy Potter is injured or dead.
Ms. Potter's murder has been all over the news down here.
I'm in D.C., not Richmond. God damn it, she thought. God damn it, that's nine. Potter makes the 9th homicide victim female on a list I have of 34 females. You make those calls, Detective, and give me a contact number where I can send you the data and evidence I have to this point. And when you make those calls, get those law enforcement officers off their asses. I've given them my prime suspect, and they have yet to interview her.
Where'd you get this list?
I'm going to send you copies of my files and reports. They're very detailed.
She turned on her computer, waited for it to boot up.
These murders cover a number of years, a number of methods, and a number of jurisdictions across the country.
And the connection?
Retribution. I'll answer any questions you have after you read the files. Make the calls.
I'll make the calls. I'll give you a contact to send the files, and I'm going to ask questions. We're already in the field and can be to you in under 2 hours.
Nearly 9:30 already, she thought. Well, fine. Just fucking fine. All right, I'm still at my office, but I need to get home shortly. You can talk to me there.
She rattled off her address.
I have one question myself, Detective. I'd like to know how she was killed. Whatever you've released to the media is enough.
The victim was killed between 23 and 0100 hours last night. Her body was discovered in the parking lot of a strip mall a few blocks from her studio at approximately 0800 this morning. It appears to be a carjacking gone south.
It's not. Contact?
When he gave it, she began sending files.
On your way here, run these individuals. Jonathan Bennett, Jr., Nikki Bennett, siblings. I'll see you in a couple of hours.
She hung up, sick, furious.
No solace tonight, she thought.
And no visit to pressure Nikki Bennett herself again.
She needed to get home, calm herself down, prepare to talk to Richmond.
Before she did, she wrote up the phone conversation, the name of the Richmond detective, the times and dates, then did a quick search on Detective Morstead. 22 years on the job, and the last 9 in major crimes.
Good and solid.
She pulled up the Richmond papers and, holding the line on personal guilt, read the details of the crime.
Carjacking my ass, she muttered,
and figured Morstead knew it. But he didn't know her, she mused. In his place, she'd hold back, too. Got in the car. Lay in wait in the car, like with Jane Arlo in Erie. Killed her right off. Why take chances? But drove the car from the studio lot to the strip mall. It would take longer to find her that way, Rachel concluded. More time to get some distance. Left her in the car, so the killer had a car, probably in the same lot. Get in, get gone. She made copies of the news reports for her files before she shut down again, locked up again. 9 now, she thought. At least 9 women dead. But by Christ, they were going to end this. They were going to shut this murderous revenge spree down. She considered calling her uncle, decided to wait until she got home, settled some. After 10 now, she noted, but he'd be up. And she'd stop for the damn ice cream. The least she could do, since she'd probably be up half the night on this and bring cops into the house. Struggling against guilt and anger, she stepped outside and started toward her car. She saw the flash, felt the sharp, bee-sting pain in her arm. She whirled, grabbed for her keys and the panic button on them. Pain speared into her chest, her shoulder. As she tumbled back, she struck her head on the door of her car, felt herself start to drift away. He moved in. He'd used a .22-caliber semi-auto to try to keep the noise down. But he knew he should have gotten closer first. The .22 didn't pack a lot of punch. He was, he had to admit, better with a knife than a gun. But he liked the way a gun barked in his hand, the way bullets just punched into people. She was bleeding pretty good, but he'd just give her one in the ear for good measure. As he closed in, he heard a burst of wild laughter, raised voices. Let her bleed to death, he thought as he got down, duck-walked back. Let her lie there and bleed out on the ground like the nosy bitch she was.
2 bitches down,
he mumbled. He eased back, then used the dark to circle wide around the building before he strolled onto a sidewalk and whistled away.
"Stay awake," she ordered herself. "Don't fade off. Oh, Jesus. Oh, God. Ethan. Our kids." No, 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 she wasn't going to do this to them. She wasn't going to die like this and leave them. She tried to call for help, but her voice barely made a croak. Shaking, she shifted enough, oh God, it hurt, to draw her phone out of her pocket. It slipped out of her fingers. Sweat, blood, shock, shakes. But she gripped it again. Pressed 911.
911, what's your emergency?
Shots fired. Shots fired. Officer down. No. No, not officer anymore. I'm shot. Parking lot.
She gave the address while her teeth began to chatter. I'm dispatching the police and an ambulance to your location. Stay with me. Stay with me. What's your name?
I'm Rachel McNee. Hit 3 times. Maybe 4. Maybe 4, I think. Hit my head. Headshot. Dunno. Chest is the worst. Losing blood. Suspect is...
Stay with me, Rachel. Help's coming.
Caucasian male. I saw him. Middle 30s. 5'10", 150. Blonde. Got a beard, little beard, and... Can't remember. I'm going out.
Stay with me, Rachel. I can hear the sirens from your phone. Just stay with me.
Can't.
And she faded. She came around again briefly while the world whirled. Light, too bright in her eyes. Voices, too loud. She couldn't think over them.
Shut up, she thought. Shut up so I can think.
She flailed out with a hand and someone, a stranger, leaned down.
We've got you. Hold on now.
Bennett.
The word slurred. She couldn't feel her tongue.
Junior shot me.
Okay, it's okay. Hold on.
But she'd already faded again. In the bathroom, Nikki huddled. Sometimes she was so cold, her body shook. Sometimes she was so hot, sweat poured. She stank. She'd tried to wash herself, but she stank anyway. She couldn't reach the light switch. Sometimes she prayed for the bulbs to burn out so she'd have some dark. Then she shuddered at the idea of being left in the dark. Her right wrist, bruised and bloody, ached. Her face, where he'd struck her, pounded. She took the pills JJ left her, and it helped. In her head, she visualized how some animals chewed off their own paw to free themselves from a trap. Could she do it? Should she try? Then the idea of that had her vomiting again. She didn't know how much time had passed. A day? A week? She ate dry cereal, crackers, an apple, a banana, and started to fear she'd run out of food, then slowly starve to death. She feared he wouldn't come back. She feared he would. She'd known. Whenever she fell into weeping, she admitted she'd known what he was. Not right. Not ever really right. Prone to meanness and violence, and covering all that up with adoring smiles for their father. He'd always hated her. She'd known that, too. Because, he'd told her once, she'd come first in birth order. Because she took parts of their father's love and attention that were rightfully his. And still she'd protected him, hadn't she? Covered for him when he snuck out at night. Washed blood out of his clothes before anyone else could see. Distracted her mother, oh, so easy to do, whenever she started to rage at him.
He'd killed their mother. Had she known that? No. No, she didn't think she'd known. Maybe suspected. A little. But she hadn't known. She'd sent him money when he needed it. Never asked questions. Didn't want to know the answers. Relieved that he mostly stayed away. She had her own life, didn't she? Didn't she? Didn't she? She huddled, weeping, laughing, aching, throbbing, hearing the gibbering of her own voice as she talked to no one. She feared she'd lose her mind for wanting to have a life. She hadn't known about the poems. She hadn't known about the killings, the women he'd killed. But she'd known it for the truth when that detective had come. She'd known, and she'd covered for her brother. Her father had told her again and again and again that was her job. She just wanted to do her job. She didn't want to die for doing her job.
Detective Morstead read Rachel's files while his partner drove. Morstead, a spit-and-polish sort, had his tie carefully knotted, his shoes perfectly shined. He'd been on the job for 22 years and attached to major crimes for nearly a decade. He kept his hair trimmed, his square-jawed face closely shaved. He had been, always would be, a detail man. In Rachel's report, he found a lot of details. His partner, 5 years and counting, Lola Deeks, had a more casual appearance. She kept her hair in a close-cut cap, but he knew, as she'd told him, that was to give her more time for important things, like sleep. She wore suit jackets or blazers, but went for flashy colors. Generally, she had a t-shirt under them rather than a button-down. She always, except dead of winter with snow, wore sneakers. By his guess, she owned at least a dozen at any given time. If he was detail, she was overall picture. He read her snippets as they pushed up 95. They discussed and debated.
"There's one here that reads like our case, except for the murder weapon. 22 caliber, back of the head for that. But in the car, from the back."
"Already in the car, like we reconstructed on Potter. She had 8 out of 34 before we added Potter. That ain't just bad luck, Bobby. She, if the PI's right on this Nikki Bennett, travels for work. Pick a target, hit the target, leave town."
"Statistically."
"Yeah, yeah." She spared him a glance. "Not typical female weapons or methods. Female serial killers are rare birds. Sometimes you catch yourself a rare bird, Bobby."
"Sometimes you do. She's requested the locals get a warrant for Bennett's travel schedule. We'll add our weight there."
He pulled on his ear.
"The motive's thin."
"Not thin so much as nuts. Straight revenge goes after the Rizzos. Mother, daughter, and the nanny. Nuts decides all the women who bang the drum with Daddy are complicit, so they all have to pay."
"It's a lot of years, Lola. A lot of patience. No mention of poems or threats except the Rizzo girl."
"She's about 30, Bobby. That's past girl, my friend. She's the one who matters most, so she gets the poems."
"Shared blood," he agreed.
"Make the connection. Torment her some. Stupid, but it's ego, too. We'll be getting off this God-cursed road shortly."
"I'm going to reach out to the lead investigator in D.C. Maybe we have a conversation there, too, while we're up here."
He located the number in the file. It surprised him when the D.C. cop picked up on the first ring.
"Detective Bauer."
"Detective Bauer, this is Detective Morstead, Richmond PD. We're investigating a homicide and believe we've made a connection to a case you're working on. We're on our way now to speak with a PI in Georgetown, Rachel McNee."
Lola glanced over when her partner's shoulders inched back. She knew his body language. Something's up, and nothing good.
"When?"
He started scribbling on the pad in his lap he'd used to make personal notes on the files.
"Where is she now?" "We'll meet you there."
He glanced at the GPS, recalculated.
15 minutes.
"There's another one?"
Lola asked when he ended the call.
"The PI took 4 bullets right outside her office, maybe a half hour after I talked to her."
"She dead?"
"Not yet. I'm going to program in the hospital. She's in surgery."
JJ made a stop at Reagan National Airport to dump the car in long-term parking and steal another. He stuffed his tied, hefty bag of bloody gear in a trash can. Though he hated giving up his smooth ride, the fucking cops had his sister's name, so they had the car. Time for a change. He got lucky with an aging, basic van with no alarm system. He broke in, transferred his bags, his weapons, his tools.
Since hot wiring the piece of shit was child's play, he headed out again inside 10 minutes. He'd need to gas up, he noted, and he'd find a safer spot to switch out the tags. Better safe than sorry. Maybe he'd pull off at a truck stop or a rest stop, grab some snacks, catch a few Z's. He still had a couple of his handy pills to give him a boost, but he had time, so maybe the Z's. No real hurry, and he wanted to savor his moments. Cops, as he'd proven time and time again, were too stupid to put the slice and dice of a reporter, newsreader, that's all she'd been, down in Virginia together with the bang-bang of a PI in D.C. They'd chase their tails on both while he drove up to Bumfuck and had some quality time with his father's bastard. His father's killer. He used his phone to locate a truck stop along the way. He had a fondness for truck stops, for the long-haul truckers. More than once, he'd asked one to mail a letter to his sweetheart at their next stop. Just a little game they played, he'd tell them, and pay for their coffee. He didn't have a poem to mail this time, but maybe he'd write one. One final poem, and leave it with her bloody, broken body. Yeah, he would. That's just what he'd do. And that poem would be published in newspapers, on the internet. Bitches like the one he'd just killed would recite it solemnly into the TV screens. He'd be famous. Make his father proud. So he should sign it this time. Not his name, of course. A title. The Bard, he thought. His father had loved Shakespeare like a brother, so that was like honoring his old man. He'd get himself some steak and eggs, some hash browns, some good, strong truck stop coffee, and write his finest poem yet. He'd read it to the bitch before he finished her. When he'd finished, when he'd taken some good pictures of her dead body, her bitch face, he'd make a quick trip back to the old homestead to deal with sister number one. No poem for her, he thought. Just a bullet in the brain. Quick and easy. A shame, he mused. He wouldn't have that well to tap for more money down the road, but she knew too much. And women couldn't keep their bitch mouths from flapping. Besides, plenty of valuables in the house to take with him. Then, like a long-haul trucker, he'd head back to Wyoming. He'd pick off the rest of the bitches on his list at his leisure. Spread them out, like always. A man didn't rush his life's work. While JJ tucked into his steak and eggs, Morstead and Deeks got off the hospital elevator. They both recognized Cop in the man pacing a few feet away. Morstead reached for his badge.
Detective Bauer?
No. The man, burly in a t-shirt and mom jeans, gave them the hard eye.
Sergeant Mooney. It's my niece, my sister's girl up in surgery. Bauer and Wachowski stepped out.
We're sorry about your niece, Sergeant, Deeks began and told him their names. Do you know her status?
Don't know a damn fucking thing except she took 4 bullets. They got them out and they're in evidence.
2 in the chest.
He tapped a fist on his own.
Called it in herself, that's what she did. That's what she's made of. Is there a suspect?
The hard eye shifted, hot now, to Morstead.
Don't stand there asking stupid questions. You're coming up to talk to her because you connected the dots, or she connected them for you. You homicide boys don't get a damn warrant for Bennett. I'm heading out myself, waking up a judge, and I will goddamn get one myself.
Sergeant.
Deeks spoke softly, one of her skills.
We caught this case less than 18 hours ago. It looks like my partner was the last person to speak with your niece before this happened. She did connect those dots for us, and we read her files, which she sent to us on the way here. If Bauer and Wachowski are unable to secure a warrant to bring Nikki Bennett in for questioning, for a search of her home, her office, her vehicles, we will do so.
Mooney held up a hand, breathed out.
I jumped on you. I had to step out of the waiting room. Rachel's husband, her 2 kids, my sister, my brother-in-law, my wife, Rachel's brother, her sister, hell, most of the family, and there are a lot of us are packed in there, or outside trying to walk this off.
My brother was shot. He attended Virginia Tech, 2007. I was just a kid. I've never been so scared in my life as I was sitting in that waiting room. It's why I became a cop.
Did he make it?
Mooney asked her.
Yeah. He was the first of my family to graduate from college.
I'm glad to hear it.
He pushed a hand over his grizzled hair.
Let's get you some coffee.
The elevator doors opened again.
Bauer, Wachowski, Morstead and Deeks.
Mooney waited for everyone to shake hands.
You get it? It's in the works, Sarge,
Bauer told him.
It's in the works. They're getting a judge out of bed.
He rubbed the back of his neck.
Wachowski talked to the LT while I talked to the prosecutor, and I got her out of bed.
We're going to put a team together,
Wachowski told the others.
A takedown team. A search team. Bowers and I will get her into interview.
You all are welcome to observe. She's got money,
he added,
so she can afford a good lawyer. We need some hard evidence. Physical evidence. If this woman shot Rachel,
Bauer continued,
we're going to nail her for it. That's a goddamn promise, Sarge. We need that search team to find us something that ties her to Rachel, to any of the others Rachel believes this woman killed.
Still in surgery?
Wachowski asked, and Mooney just nodded.
When she comes out of it, when she comes around, she'll help us nail it down. We were moving on it.
Bauer lightly pounded his fist on his thigh.
We were going over to talk to Bennett today. We couldn't get to it before. Then we got slammed with that double.
Mooney waved it away.
I didn't see it as hot either. I should have. I didn't.
He broke off, strode away when he saw one of the doctors in scrubs. His heart pounded in his throat, in his ears.
You were operating on Rachel McNee. I'm her uncle.
I remember.
The quiet-voiced, weary-eyed woman nodded.
Dr. Stringer, your niece is stable. She's strong and she's stable. She's in serious condition and we'll watch her closely for the next 12 hours. She came through the surgery well.
Can you tell the family? They're going to want to see her. I know that horde can't all go see her, but her husband, her kids, her mom, they need to see her.
She'll be sedated through the night, but yes, we'll arrange for that.
They ain't going anywhere till she wakes up.
Cafeteria's 24/7. I can arrange to have a cot brought in for her husband once she's out of recovery. The shoulder and arm wounds were minor. The chest wounds, more serious, as we already discussed. She also lacerated the back of her head in the fall, I believe. I want to say it's a wonder she stayed conscious and able to contact 911.
You don't know Rachel.
The doctor smiled. I do now. I hope you find who did this to her.
Count on it. Family's all in there, or most of them.
He turned to the other cops.
Give me 5 minutes with the family, then I'm in on this takedown. Sarge, don't fuck with me on this. I've been a cop damn near as long as you've been alive, Bauer. I'm not going to do anything to jeopardize the case against the individual who put my niece in the hospital, and I'm going to be there when you take her in. 5 minutes. We need to get back to the house, suit up, brief the team. We'll be on that.
Morstead waited for the frustrated looks.
To observe and assist only. It's your takedown, detectives, but we will need to interview the suspect regarding our victim. Fair enough. Take your five, Mooney. Sarge, I'm really glad Rachel's coming through.
Deeks looked toward the waiting room as she heard the weeping.
Relief tears,
she said.
They sound different from grief. It's good to hear them.
Chapter 29. Since the pain wouldn't die, Nikki took more pills. She dozed off and on, then took more. Her ears rang, and though it seemed impossible, her head ached more, like jackhammers digging into her brain. Because of the length of the chain, she could only stand in a crouch, but when she tried, her head spun, and she'd have to sit again, or vomit again. So she took more pills. Sometimes she heard voices, but when she held her breath to scream for help, she realized the voices were her own. No one but JJ could get in the house, and he wouldn't come to help. She surfaced again, sick and shaking, eyes tearing, ears.